Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Hi there, you're listening to a multi-part episode, so be sure to tune in and subscribe to catch all of this series of episodes to fully experience this topic. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Doctor.
All right, so you're visiting here in Portland.
Right, we are face-to-face.
We are face-to-face, yes. Yeah. The last time we did this was when we interviewed Dr. Leonard Spates.
That's right.
In season one. But we had the opportunity to connect because we had our commencement together.
Right.
It's been great having you over. Right. We've had a lot of conversations.
Should have been recording all along.
Well, yeah, but then I'd have days of audio.
All right, you have a huge editing job then. Yeah.
And right now we have the opportunity to, you know, narrow it down. So right. Welcome to season two, whoever is listening on the internet or your downloaded device or whatever it may be. Right. We decided to go with a season system instead of a continual episode system. It makes it easier for our listeners because they may tire of our voices throughout the year.
That's true.
And they get some breaks. So season two, we've got all designed where we're going to have topics for each episode, but we're going to jump right into the thick of it, and we're going to discuss, I'd like to discuss what you're currently doing with Extinction Rebellion.
Right. Well, that's a very appropriate topic for me to dive into because as we graduated yesterday, mm-hmm. the past 3 years of going through this cohort program for the doctorate is the culmination of ministry calling and direction and wandering and everything. But it led me directly into awareness of the climate crisis, awareness of the sixth mass extinction that we've inflicted upon ourselves, the first time in the history of the world. There have been five prior extinction events. 60 million years ago, I think, was the last one. That was the famous dinosaur extinction. But now, we're in the sixth extinction event, and it's already on us, and we caused it. And I'm going, and this is in my dissertation, we're a sentient species. We're aware of our surroundings. We use sense of things through all our five or six senses, however many you want to count. And we're sapient, because we're wise, homo sapiens, we're homo sentients, we're homo sapiens, but we're insane because no sentient, sapient species would kill themselves. But that's exactly what we've done. We've created a climate in which we're dying. A million species are going to die in the next decade, and we're going to be in the death toll. Not entirely. It's hard to say how much of it is going to inflict us, but 50% is almost certain, and it could go as high as 80-90% dead. So I'm an older guy. I'll be 70 this year, actually.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. So I'm not really having to worry about this because within a decade, odds are I'll be pretty close to the end of my life anyway, and I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that. But I've got kids, millennial kids, like your age, mm-hmm. and I've got grandkids, like the age of your kids. And I'm going, what world am I leaving them? And it makes me furious at my boomer generation because we let this happen. We could have stopped this, but we didn't. We sold out. We sold into the capitalist regime that runs the world. And it's given us all these techie gadgets and comforts and indulgences. And it just the list is endless of what we sold out to. But we sold our children's legacy when we did that. And not just the quality of life, but the existence of human life is what we sold out. And it makes me furious. I did it. I've done it myself. I went into the corporate world and just, you know, lived that life. And I look back on my life and I'm ashamed. And I look at my compatriots, my boomer generation colleagues, cohort, and I go, what were we thinking? How did we let this happen? But here we are, and it's catastrophic, and we're a decade away from it being irreversible. And the science is in. This is not mm-hmm. a scientific issue. The science is in.
So to clarify, scientific, not scientism, which you do make a distinction of in your dissertation.
Absolutely. Scientism is a value judgment. And it says scientific knowledge is the best, if not the only knowledge, real genuine knowledge. Radical or strong scientism says it's the only genuine knowledge. Moderate, weaker scientism says it's the best knowledge. And that's a value judgment. That's not a provable claim.
I could see where a lot of people would agree with the weaker part, where it's the best type of knowledge.
Right.
I can't think of anybody in my life that's going to say science and the scientific process is the only knowledge.
We don't hang out with atheists.
Oh, I do know plenty. I live in Portland. I know plenty of atheists.
Yeah.
They have a lot of personal feelings about things, and they'll acknowledge, you know, this is my personal value set.
Right.
And you're in the Pacific Atheist Force, and we have value sets that are not driven based off science. Because if we were to go, I don't want to delve too much into this, and I don't want to offend people, but if we're dealing with the LGBTQIA+, if we deal with that group, whatever somebody's beliefs on that, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not judging somebody on that. I'm saying strictly on that, then we're coming to the same problem. If you have a society that is supposed to continue to future generations but does not develop a future generation because there's no offspring, that's not very scientific. So, people follow their hearts more than their scientific understanding a lot of the time.
I see what you're saying, and I get your point, and it's a valid point. I think following their heart is where I'm a little bit reluctant to go along with what you're saying entirely.
Maybe more like an emotional judgment.
They're following their flesh. And I don't mean that in the sexual connotations of the whole acronym there.
Okay? So in the Jewish world, we have the phrase Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, which is just the desires of my body, because my spiritual side and my physical side always have different desires and they butt heads.
Yes.
So I'm not saying whether or not the inclination's evil. I mean, flipping off a cop, probably not the best idea, evil. But, you know, I'm not necessarily going to say eating that chocolate bar is the most evil thing I've done.
Correct, right.
But
Lord willing, I'd be in serious trouble if chocolate was an evil.
Yeah, but I guess my point is saying that I don't personally know a lot of atheists who believe full-hearted into the scientism, because they have a lot of personal, what's true for me, the postmodern concepts.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of two groups in particular.
Okay.
Who are called the New Atheists and the New Optimists.
Okay.
If you look at their writings, and let me clarify who I mean by they. By the New Optimists, I mean people like Steven Pinker and Johan Norberg, whose book we read in the cohort, Progress, right? 10 Reasons to Believe in the Future or something. I forget the subtitle, but the main title is Progress. Johan Norberg. He's a fellow of the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. So is Steven Pinker. So they're colleagues at the Cato Institute, which is a Koch brothers kind of institute. And that's all fine and good. You know, you got to have your think tanks. But these guys are the vanguard of the New Atheists, just like, the New Optimists. Now, who are the New Atheists? Their names escape me at the moment, but there's the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism.
Are we talking like Dawkins, or is he...
Dawkins is one, and there's three others. And there's a woman who is, interestingly enough, she's Mideastern. I'm not sure more precisely than that. I think she's Egyptian.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. But she's Mideastern. She's very feminist, very radical. And the Four Horsemen have kind of drawn her into their circle. And I can't think of her name, but she's written books about this. And she tends to come across as being atheistic. But as I looked into what she was writing, she wasn't that atheistic. She was much more just radically feminist. But she wasn't denying spirituality and divinity.
Okay.
But anyway, all of that to say, the New Atheists, what their common denominator is, this new optimism for the future, it's just, I mean, Pinker's book's title of his book is Enlightenment Now, for goodness sake. Well, the Enlightenment's 400 years old, at least. 15th century. Right?
I don't feel like it was very enlightening.
It was darkening. I mean, it literally darkened the spiritual reality of being a human being and went into, guess what? Scientism.
That's kind of anti-Mandorla. It
definitely broke the consonance, the resonance, the harmony between the spiritual and the material, or the worldly and the divine transcendent reality, it broke that mandorla harmony. And it's been collapsing ever since. And because it's so freaking profitable, you can make so much money when you break those two apart. Here we are. We're facing extinction as a species. And in order to rationalize that, you have to adopt a value system based on a fundamental premise that the best knowledge you can attain, if not the only real knowledge you can attain, is scientific, empirical, experiential knowledge. What you analytically know and think based on what you happen to experience, especially if you design that experience through experiment, if you regard that as the best or the only knowledge that's accessible to humans, you can pretty much justify anything. Because science is value-free. Scientism, despite being a value judgment, doesn't impose any values. Scientists are, like doctors especially, are trained not to bring value judgments into their work. Objectivity, right? You have to be objective as a scientist. So, all of that to say, we are living in a culture built on that Enlightenment scientism. And new optimism and new atheism both bottom out in that scientism, that value judgment, especially the new optimists. But the new atheists, the argument they will give you for the non-existence of anything divine is science. But they're really speaking scientism. The category mistake at work there, and I don't mean to go on about this so long, has always been Polanyi that we read in our cohort, Michael Polanyi, I forget the name of it, Personal Knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Great book, excellent perspective on the issue of science versus religion, theology versus faith and theology. His position was really well developed, but what it did not quite nail down is the category mistake. And what does Lynn say about category mistakes?
That's an issue.
They're the worst mistakes you can make, right? And you cannot use science to justify faith and theology. You can't use faith and theology to justify rational science. They're different belief systems, but they aren't necessarily at odds. They just have different axiomatic foundations, different assumptions upon which they rest. People say, the new atheists and optimists will say, oh, but science doesn't have any assumptions. It's proven fact. Only if you believe in laws of non-contradiction.
Well, science, from my perspective, I try to be objective, and so I fall into this thinking error process, but science is not just proven fact. And because there's this huge category that we call theories, which is not proven. A theory is something that has not been a proven fact. They just haven't found a way to necessarily disprove
it. Well, let's be careful, because it depends on what you mean by proof.
Well, I'm not saying evidence.
Ah, okay.
I'm saying proof. So, for example,
logical, analytic proof.
Well, we have two. When I say theory, a lot of people immediately jump to the theory of creation. Is it intelligent design or is it evolution? That's been the big public debate for ages now. And the thing is, I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, well, evolution's a proven fact. And I can say, yes, microevolution, small changes, is a proven fact, but we haven't proven a jump from one species to another yet. Macroevolution, we haven't proven it right, which is why it's called a theory, because a theory is something that we have evidence to suggest this, but there's no hard-on proof,
right.
And we haven't disproved it yet because we haven't found where God's sitting or whatever.
Fingerprint. Yeah,
yeah, that what we found, a fingerprint's in evidence.
Yeah.
That comes back, like, in the Jewish perspective, if God's incorporeal, of course you're not going to find God using a scientific method.
Right.
That you cannot prove, and that's where we come back to faith.
And there's the category mistake. And when you get into even the most rational science, which is not science as we know it under scientism, the only rational science model I know of came from Jim Fetzer in Scientific Knowledge, his 1981 magnum opus. And believe me, that's a corpus of work that's difficult to get through. But he does establish a rational foundation for genuine scientific knowledge and understanding. But to get there, even there, and certainly in all the scientismic posturing about science, you have to start with axioms. And it's typically the three laws of thought: non-contradiction, identity, and what is the other one? Excluded middle. P and not P can't both be true. It's either P or it's not P, where P is just any proposition whatsoever, right? Excluded middle is one or the other of them is true. Okay? Mm-hmm. Can't be both, but one of them is true. And identity is P equals P. Things are what they are, in other words. That's just the identity. Those are the three laws of thought. You can't prove them. There's no evidence for them other than they are tautologies, self-evident truths, which we take to be true based on what? Faith. So science ultimately is grounded in faith, just like the simple side of Lynn's simplexity, simple faith, complex theology. The simple side of it is the creed, or just the acceptance of a divinity. What would the Hebrew side of that be, the Jewish side of that be?
This is where, depending on your faith tradition within Judaism, I actually want to touch on something you just mentioned with the whole peeing, not peeing, those three models within Kabbalah. And I want to give a disclosure here. When I refer to Kabbalah, I'm not talking Kabbalah Center that sells you holy water for $10 a bottle that cures cancer. I can't say negative things about them. That would be evil talk, gossip, slander. I don't want to do that. What I want to do is say I'm talking about Kabbalah from an Orthodox perspective that has been discussed by reliable figures, that has been cited, and has a tradition, because Kabbalah is our received tradition. So I'm not jumping into mystical ends and lands that doesn't have some root in Torah or from a strong Torah figure.
Right.
And that's what I do in Kabbalah Pod. But within Kabbalah, we have a concept regarding 1 plus 1.
Uh-huh.
1 plus 1 equals 1.
Okay.
A mom plus a dad equals a child.
I see what you mean. Okay.
And we apply this to the spiritual as well.
Okay.
How does that fit in with your three methods?
Well, the three laws of thought are classic Western European. That's where that all came from.
And I'm talking Eastern here.
Well, it's ancient Greece, actually. Yeah. I mean, because that logic goes back to Aristotle. Those three laws of thought go back to Aristotelian logic, which is 500 years B.C. And so the Greek influence there is interesting, because those two they seem like oil and water. They seem very dissonant. I'd have to think about that. However, my first intuitive response to it is the three laws of thought are what's called extensional language, okay? And extensional language, E-X-T-E-N-S-I-O-N-A-L, not extensional, but extensional with an S.
Yeah.
And it's an important distinction. Mathematics, is 99.9% of people know it, is an extensional language, which means it can describe history, but it is utterly meaningless in predicting the future, because the future isn't history yet. And all an extensional language can do is describe history. Now, if you're just describing history, the three laws of thought kind of make sense. Either this happened or it didn't. Right? It did or it didn't, but it didn't both happen and not happen. See, so looking backwards from the present, they tend to be analytically more acceptable. But looking forward, you can't say either it's going to happen or it isn't with the same kind of confidence. Now you're into a whole different kind of language. You're into what's called an intentional with an S, not mm-hmm. intent, but intense, intentional language, which is a world, the semantics of possible worlds, right? Now, we're getting into pretty esoteric logic here.
Yeah.
But keeping that intentional, extensional distinction, extensional about the history of what has been, intentional about the possibility of what could be, you're in possible semantics. You can't do science without possible world semantics. Okay? And part of that reason is because you get into number systems like fractal geometry, complex number systems, where one and one don't always come out to be two. I mean, okay. When you get into the fractal complex number system, whole different algebras and whole different calculi begin to emerge. And the rules of those, the classic extensional mathematical language, they just don't work like they did before. So that's my first intuitive response from the analytic side of my thinking, is that there's that fundamental distinction between the language of what has been as fact and the language of what might be as tomorrow's facts. Okay? And until you can cross that tipping point into the intentional semantics of possible worlds, you can't even do rational science. And that's one of the fundamental flaws, as Fetzer explains in his book, of what passes for science today, which always brings to mind Thomas Kuhn, right? You know who he is, the structure of scientific revolutions?
You've mentioned him, I just haven't read his work.
It's a classic work. There's really there's two books of his worth reading, mm-hmm. Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and I forget the exact title, but it was about 5 years earlier he wrote a book on the Copernican Revolution in particular. And he uses that in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions to show we don't plan scientific advance. We stumble into it, or it comes out of left field. It's always a revolutionary transition. Relativity theory revolutionized Newton. Newton revolutionized what came before Newton. Escapes my mind at the moment. Copernicus revolutionized Ptolemaic cosmology. These weren't, we did this experiment and made this discovery. What happens is they keep doing experiments and they get results that they can't explain until finally somebody says, you're looking at things all wrong. Here's how you ought to look at it. And then we get a whole new revolutionary way of looking at things, relativity and quantum theory as opposed to Newtonian mechanics. Kuhn is the one who understood this as the history of science. And his book is you can't do philosophy of science without reading Thomas Kuhn. It's just like the primer, you know.
Yeah.
68. 63, something like that, he wrote that book. And the 50th anniversary was in 2013, so it would have been 63. And it's to be taken seriously in any discussion of philosophy of science. That's one of the milestone books. But in it, like I say, he explains how it's not the structured, systematic approach to science that leads to the advances. It's the revolutions. You know, the unexpected, the unexplainable. And we're in a period right now where Einstein's relativity and Heisenberg and the others and their quantum mechanics, the clay feet of those idols are cracking. I mean, just take dark energy and dark matter.
I was just thinking about that, actually.
Well, what are they? You don't know. That's why they're dark. and yet, now how's this for paradox? We say things like, you'll read scientismists saying things like, well, we really only know about 5 or 6% of what exists.
Yeah.
And like 67%, I'm kind of pulling numbers out of the air here, but of the 95 that's left, 67% is made up of dark matter and 38% is made up of dark energy. And I'm going, if you don't know, how do you know the percentages? Just let's say, what it comes down to, and there's a growing willingness among most science is now theoretical mathematical physics. It's not really as much experimental as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
They laud the experiments, but they rarely tell you what they're really finding out, because what they're really finding out is we don't know jack. I mean, the Big Bang has come under question, serious question.
Mm-hmm.
Dark matter, dark energy, and it's becoming quite clear. There's a book that just came out on this. It's becoming quite clear that what's really going on is they have these elaborate theories and these corollaries and these lemmas and these hypotheses that are like band-aids patched onto the theory to keep it coherent. So think in accounting terms. These are juggled books passing as science, because we just keep kind of throwing heuristic adjustments into the numbers to keep the model intact. That's dark matter and dark energy. Heuristic number balancing of the mathematics, of the theories that prevail. It's cooked books. It's the same thing that happened in the Department of Defense when they did their first audit. And they didn't pass because they found $21 trillion unaccounted for. And you go, what could we have done with $21 trillion?
It's a lot of chocolate.
A lot. It's a lot of chocolate. Exactly. It's a lot of education. It's a lot of health care. It's a lot of, it's a solution to poverty And look at the dent it could have put in the fossil fuel existential crisis we're facing. It's just, that's a whole other topic. And I'm talking too much. I'm monopolizing this story.
Well, no, it's very interesting. And what it seems like we're doing is we're unpacking a lot of what you've been percolating over this past year.
That's kind of where this question started. I mean, yeah. It took me 3 years to come through this cohort to arrive at Extinction Rebellion as the next stage of what I'm calling my ministry.
So before you started this program, would you have seen yourself on this path?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. In broad, general terms, yes, because I have some roots in activism. I was not a frontline activist in the 60s, but I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I looked down the barrel of guns at the University of Kentucky, and friends of mine were holding the guns from my high school years. I mean, it was an odd time. I was at UK when the ROTC building was burned. Now, University of Kentucky, you have to, I mean, this is on the periphery. It's not even on the level of Kent State, for instance, which in fact happened this month, back in 50 years ago. So in those general terms, yes, this is an ongoing thing. And I went into the program because I was drawn into finding some way of putting together my midlife coming to Christ with everything that had come before in terms of philosophy, science, and mathematics, and logic, and all that. Because I'm going, okay, I've learned all about what truth is from a philosophical, analytic, logical, mathematical model of reality, philosophy of science. Now I've got this funny relationship with actual living person, truth, Christ. That's kind of a dilemma. How do I put this together? That's what led me to the program.
Okay.
And now it starts becoming particular. Like Lynn says, I went from the universal to the particular here. He says it goes the other way. But the program brought me through putting resonant harmony between truth as a person and truth as rational science. He got that resonant harmony together. It's in the dissertation. But at the same time, the Lord used it to take me out of a history of ministry and Bible translation and humanitarian aid at World Vision into my own, what am I going to do next as ministry? And as the dissertation started coming together, the key problem became the sixth mass extinction and the church's absolute oblivion. No awareness of the issue. I mean, Lynn is the only person I've been able to find who's aware of the problem and is willing to talk about it. I mean, if I go to my local pastors, and I don't want to offend any of them, but I've sat in on their sermons and services and their Bible studies for years, and things like this just don't come up. We don't talk about scientism. We don't talk about science. We don't talk about climate crisis. We talk about what I would call first grade exegesis Bible study. You know, it's pretty frustrating.
Yeah, before I left the evangelical fold, I definitely agree with you on that.
So. Yeah, and Lynn's a pretty strident critic of the mainstream church. He has a solution with his MR, missional, relational, incarnational simplicity of Christianity.
Yeah, but he's a black sheep because of his
approach. Exactly. He's marginalized, and I've asked people in every church I've been to, in conversation, what are your views and so on. It's never quite that good a question. But anyway, I'll often mention Lynn. And they go, who's he? I don't know who he is. And I'm going, well, he's probably one of the least known, most visionary Christian leaders in the planet.
Which is fascinating, because if you check his Wikipedia, he's one of the top 85 Christian authors.
Exactly. I mean, he's got the cred
from
the community, sort of. But you got to separate the fraternity from the guild. The fraternity likes him, okay, which is why he has the wonderful appointments as distinguished professor at three universities and all the things that he's got, and 67 books now, 68 books in print.
Maybe. Last I heard from him, he was trying to avoid writing more than books of the Bible.
I know, but yeah, I don't think he's going to make it. I think Rings of Fire is going to put him up at the top.
Well, you know.
That's the one that's coming. And he's got another one in progress, as well as Rings of Fire.
If you can do it, why would you stop?
Exactly. But I just have not found in the church a willingness, and I'll be blunt, an open-mindedness to even be challenged to think about these things.
Well, no, that's because Christianity has become a political decision, not a... It doesn't involve a brain. I mean, I know people who, oh, yes, I believe in abortion. Oh, yes, I believe in climate change. They have their come-to-Jesus moment. What? Well, I never believed in climate change. And it's unfortunate. It's like,
yeah,
the brain shouldn't turn off. It should expand the horizon.
Christ himself challenges us to do that. I mean, and I know it's in your both sides of your Jewish tradition.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a very Jewish concept, book knowledge. I mean, yeah, the common joke regarding a Jewish home is that there's more books than chairs and that type of thing. It's just a library.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, there's so many works that are published. Well,
committed mainstream Christians read a lot. But the number of authors they're reading is usually fewer than the number of fingers on their hands. And they read the same ones over and over. They all go to the same Bible studies with the same people over and over. And they have the same conversations over and over. And so there's nothing fresh. There's no fresh air breathed into their Christian worldview. It isn't that it's non-Christian. It's just sterile, impotent Christianity because there's no breath of life in it. They've lost the way, they've lost the truth, and they've abandoned the life. They still bear the name, just like I wear, you know, Hathaway shirts or whatever. But do I think about Hathaway? Never. You know, do I think about Polo? No. But I just kind of wear those brands without thinking about it. And many, many Christians do that. Now, that's not to say that they aren't faithful in reading their Bible or they aren't faithful in going to church. I shouldn't say faithful. I should say diligent, disciplined in routines that display their name as a Christian. But their identities are not in the living Christ. You know, because if their identities were in the living Christ, they would be crying out in pain and suffering for what's happening around us. I mean, when I really got involved a couple of months ago in Extinction Rebellion, I wept every day. And I mean, not just boo-hooing. You've heard me say it before. I wept just grievous tears. And my daughter always challenges me. She thinks I'm too angry. She thinks I come across as angry, and I am angry. And she challenges me. She says, "You need to look, Dad, because every anger is rooted in fear." And I take that point. A lot of times when I peel back the anger and the rage I feel at the life I'm in, I find fear. But beneath every one of those fears, it's fear for my children, it's fear for me, it's fear for my wife, it's fear for my friends. It's, you know, there are fears there at work. But beneath all of that is a black hole of grief. And I'm mad because I have to grieve. Not because I'm afraid. I'm mad because I have to grieve the reality that we've made for ourselves. It's a black hole of grief. And I like the metaphor because extinction, mass extinction, has mm-hmm. crossed over the event horizon of that black hole. We're into a gravitational whirlpool that we're 10 years away from it being utterly inescapable. We're already over the event horizon to where we're going to have serious consequences that are going to change everything, as the world as we know it. What's the old cliche? The end of the world as we know it, Teotihuacan or whatever it was. It's a reality now. We're over that event horizon. The question is, will we be able to back away and get back across to the other side? And if it's a real true human event horizon, no. There may be something like humanity after this mass extinction, but it ain't going to be humanity as we know it. We will be genetically different. we will be intellectually different. We will be different species if we survive at all. I firmly believe that. And for me, the grief that comes with believing that and having the evidence scientifically that supports it, I mean, there are deniers out there, but they're hangers-on. One of my blog posts is about the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, mm-hmm. and I use Lynn's well curve to represent it as an inverted bell curve. And the climate deniers are on the left side, and extinction rebellion's on the right side. And the extinction event is in the sink of that well. And that's a very accurate representation of the reality we're in. If you're denying it, you can cling to that as long as you want to until you have to stop breathing, because the air is not going to be breathable, the water's not going to be drinkable, the food's not going to be edible, and life on this planet is not going to exist as we know it today. So your intellectual options are going to disappear quickly. So the deniers are kind of, and they cling desperately to saying, oh, the science is bogus, you know. And Freeman Dyson is one of the ones they like to quote, because he's a reputable scientist from a while back, and he has an argument against it. But he's a lone voice. And I'm a lone voice, so I empathize with that. But he's just mistaken on this one. I mean, the two favorite phrases that I've come across that describe it are both actually come from the World Economic Forum. The elite of the elite of the elite, who are the, if you, for lack of a better phrase, are the fascist capitalist cabal that's running the world. And they have a meeting every year in January in Davos, Switzerland. 10 years ago, well, 2011, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon gave a speech, and in it he said, we are in a global suicide pact. We've entered into a pact to mutually just destroy ourselves. An industrial revolution is what got us there. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but the global suicide pact is his phrase. This year, this January 2019, every year they have a report done to tell the World Economic Forum what the big problems are they need to face. And this is a quote, we are sleepwalking into catastrophe. And the climate change, the climate 6 mass extinction is exactly what they're talking about. Hmm. And everywhere you look, the science is not in question. The problem is the scientists don't want to tell us how bad it is. I mean, everything I've been reading, the scientists are saying, well, it's really bad. And the commentators who are interviewing them are saying, they just don't want to tell us what's really coming. So, you know, grit your teeth and buckle up, buckaroo. It's not going to be a carnival ride. So anyway, all of that to say, the overall arc of my life led me into the program, and the impact of the program led me from a history of ministry and activism into a particular activism as ministry now. And by the way, there's a sizable community of Christians involved in Extinction Rebellion. There's a whole chapter that is Christians Extinction Rebellion.
Okay.
I don't know about the Jewish, though. I wish you'd look into that and let me know.
Well, we'll dive into that. We're going to pause right there. We're going to say this is the end of this episode.
We're going to continue. No, I didn't mean to monopolize it.
Oh, no. This is a two-part episode. And so this first episode is just unpacking the beginning of this shell. Okay. And tune into the next episode to continue this conversation and hear the rest of what we have to say. We're going to hit pause right there. So tune into our next episode as we continue the conversation. Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semiobites is a podcast co-hosted by Yedbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiach analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semiobites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.